Welcome to NCLA's Lunch and Law Series, Gundy versus U.S., the end of non-delegation or new beginning. My name is Steve Simpson. I'm a senior litigation counsel here at NCLA. And let me get to our panel. To my immediate left is Professor David Schoenbrod. David is a trustee professor of law at New York Law School, where he has, over the course of his career, taught subjects such as administrative law, environmental law, constitutional law, and remedies. An expert on non-delegation, Professor Schoenbrod began his career at the Natural Resources Defense Council in the 1970s. After 7 years, he decided to speak out about the trends he'd been seeing in practice. The result was not only a great teaching career, but also a prolific career as an author. Among many books, Professor Schoenbrod wrote the widely praised Power Without Responsibility, How Congress Abuses the People Through Delegation. That and other works by Professor Schoenbrod were cited by Justice Gorsuch in his dissent in the Gundy case. Professor Schoenbrod's latest book is called DC Confidential, Inside the Five Tricks of Washington. And I'm also happy to say that David is on NCLA's Board of Advisors. Next, we have Mark Chenoweth to Professor Schoenbrod's left. Mark is, as probably many of you know, NCLA's Executive Director and General Counsel. Mark has observed the administrative state from perches in all four branches of the federal government, which I take to be a real feat in as much as I read the Constitution, there are only three branches of the federal government. Somehow Mark has actually managed to work for four branches. So let's go through them. Mark served as Chief of Staff to Congressman Mike Pompeo. That's legislative. He was an attorney in the Office of Legal Policy at the Department of Justice. That's executive. He served as a law clerk for the Honorable Danny Boggs on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. That's obviously judicial. And finally, he was legal counsel to a commissioner at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which, of course, is the not-so-secret fourth branch of government, otherwise known as the administrative state. And that takes us into the Gundy case. The Gundy case, and I'll describe the facts in a moment, but the basic issue in Gundy is what's known as the non-delegation doctrine. And among many other things, we think of it here as one of the pillars of the foundations of the administrative state, and to say nothing of the fact that, in our view, it is wildly unconstitutional for Congress to delegate its power to administrative agencies. So what we're going to do is talk about the issues in the Gundy case, and in particular, the makeup of the court and what the court did in the case, and really what the future holds in the case. It's an exciting and interesting case and an exciting and interesting time to be in the space of administrative law, and Gundy is a very important case. So I want to start off by, give a quick description of the facts in Gundy, and then we can talk a bit about the non-delegation doctrine, what it's all about, and then we can dig deeper into the actual decision, and in particular, the dissent, which I think is where all the action is. So the facts in Gundy are actually pretty straightforward, and I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. It involves an act passed by Congress in 2006 called the Sex Offender Registration and Notification Act, otherwise known as SORNA. That's the acronym. Long story short, SORNA takes it. The point of SORNA was to bring uniformity to an otherwise non-uniform or patchwork of laws that, in essence, require sex offenders to register with the government. Now, one of the issues in SORNA, it was passed in 2006. It defined the requirements for people who were convicted of sex offenses after the act was passed. And it had a fair amount of specificity about what they had to do to register with the government. It didn't do so with any really level of specificity to people who had violated or been convicted of sex offenses prior to the passage of the act. Now, there are a variety of reasons why it made that distinction and why it didn't contain much specificity with respect to pre-act offenders. I'll just summarize that by saying it was complicated and controversial for Congress to do so. And so Congress did what Congress often does when it faces controversial and complicated issues, which is to say it punted to a different branch of government. In the event, it handed over broad authority to the Attorney General. And I'll just highlight what the provision says. to specify what the requirements of the act were for pre-act offenders. It's about one paragraph in the law. The gist of it is Congress gave the Attorney General the authority to, quote, specify the applicability of SORNA's registration requirements to pre-act offenders and to, quote, prescribe rules for their registration. That's about all it really says. So it's got detailed requirements for some offenders and almost nothing, and just hands authority over to the Attorney General. Herman Gundy, who is the petitioner in the case, or was, he pled guilty before SORNA was passed to a sex offense. He was imprisoned for a number of years. SORNA is passed. He gets out. He's not registered under the act, and he's convicted again for not being registered under the act. And I think he's given a 10-year prison sentence. But in any event, it was pretty substantial. It's not. This is not small potatoes here. This is a real serious crime to be convicted for violating SORNA. And so he brings, as part of his defense, a challenge to the act under what's known as the non-delegation doctrine. He argues that the provision I read before grants too much authority to an executive branch official, which Congress can't do under the so-called non-delegation doctrine. So let me pause there. And I want to, before we get into the discussion of the decision, I want us to just discuss a little bit about what is this thing we call the non-delegation doctrine. It's not a really familiar principle to most people. So let me start then. I'm going to start, Mark, with you. If you can give us a kind of thumbnail sketch, what is the non-delegation doctrine? Where does it come from? What are its constitutional roots? Just to sort of, you know, orient the audience about what it is that we're talking about here. What's the issue?
Sure. Non-delegation doctrine is a little bit of a misnomer, because when you hear that something is a doctrine, you, at least I immediately think that it's something that's court invented. But in this case, it's really not. It's really right there at the very beginning of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 1, all legislative power shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. So what even though it's been called non-delegation, it's also a misnomer for a second reason, which is that calling it a delegation or saying that Congress cannot delegate its power is a little bit different than what the Constitution actually says, which is that that Congress cannot divest its power. And I think there's an important distinction between those two words, and that's one of the points that we made in our brief, and one of the points that Professor Hamburger has hammered home. When you talk about a delegation of authority, that sounds like something that you can take back. If an executive branch official were to delegate to his or her deputy to do something and then change his or her mind, well, you can just bring that back very easily. But if Congress, quote-unquote, delegates power to the executive branch, and the executive branch does something that Congress doesn't like, in order to undo that, what does Congress have to do? It has to pass a new law, bicameralism and presentment. That new law has to be signed by the president, the executive branch. So if Congress gives power to the executive branch, and the executive branch doesn't want to give it back, it would actually take a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress to get that back. That doesn't sound like a delegation to me. That sounds like a complete divestment of legislative power, which is exactly what Article 1, Section 1 forbids. But to answer your question more specifically, Steve, the non-delegation doctrine purports to say that as long as there's an intelligible principle that Congress has specified in the statute to guide the executive's discretion in implementing the statute, then that suffices. That's the current state of the law, even post-Gundy.
And to flesh that out just a little bit, Mark talked about the intelligible principle test. I often think of it as neither a principle nor intelligible. It's as the court has actually implemented. And just to give you a couple quick examples of what the court has considered to be an intelligible principle, regulate in the, quote, public interest. So hand authority over to an agency to regulate it in the public interest. The court has upheld that as an intelligible principle. Set fair and equitable prices. Again, that the court has upheld delegations to agencies to set fair and equitable principles. And finally, just another example, I think this is under the Clean Air Act, issue air quality standards that, quote, are requisite to protect the public health. This is the kind of broad delegation or divestment of power that Congress often hands over to administrative agencies, calling that an intelligent or those examples an intelligible principle, I think is a misnomer, to say the least. But David, let me ask you before we turn to the Gundy decision and what it held. So you wrote a book called Power Without Responsibility, which gets into one of the, I mean, you could call it either, I mean, you can obviously characterize this, but either a practical or a constitutional issue or problem with delegation. And can you give a kind of flavor of what's one of the problems with Congress handing its power over to administrative agencies?
Well, I think there's actually a constitutional problem and a practical problem. The constitutional problem starts with the Declaration of Independence proclaiming that governments derive their just powers from the consent of the people. And what the drafters of the Constitution offered the people was a deal under which the most important powers of government would be exercised by elected officials who would be personally responsible for how they exercised those powers in the past. That would therefore give the people the power to hold them accountable for how they exercise those legislative powers, especially the power to make law, to make the rules of conduct that govern the voters. What delegation does is it allows these elected officials to pass the buck to the agencies. Now, that's good for the elected officials, but it's bad for the voters. And that's why I left the Natural Resources Defense Council after 7 years. I saw that we were getting more expensive, less effective protection from air pollution because of the delegation. And so, in other words, delegation is good for politicians, it's bad for voters. And I want to just read you something from a decision that Justice Kagan, who was with the majority in, or with the plurality in Gundy, wrote recently. The need for judicial review is at its most urgent in cases where politicians' incentives conflict with voters' interests. That's delegation.
Yeah, that's a really good point. So with that, then, let's actually talk about the actual decision. What did the court do? And a couple points to make up front. First, this was only 8 justices participated in this decision. Justice Kavanaugh had just been, or he wasn't confirmed when the case was argued before the Supreme Court. So he didn't participate in the decision. So you have only 8 justices, which creates, it really sets up what ultimately happened, which is you get a very fractured decision. Which is both, I mean, it's interesting news and I think good news ultimately, but we can talk about that. The plurality or the court's judgment ultimately was announced by Justice Kagan writing for a plurality with Justices Breyer, Ginsburg, and Sotomayor. Justice Alito sided with, I mean, he ultimately concurred in the judgment, but it's a kind of a fascinating concurrence. All he basically says is, I don't think the delegation at issue here violates our prior precedents, which is to say I don't think it doesn't include an intelligible principle. But he goes on to say that he doesn't that if a majority of the court wants to revisit the non-delegation doctrine and the court's precedents, he'd support that effort, but he thinks it's, quote, freakish to do that with respect to only one law. So this is, I think, Justice Alito saying he would be willing to really consider overturning the court's prior precedents. Justice Gorsuch, joined by Roberts and Thomas, dissents, and his position is, no, now is the time to take on this issue. There's a real significant problem with the whole idea of delegating, Congress delegating to executive branch, typically executive branch, agencies, and he wants to do it now. So we'll dig into those decisions. I'm not going to talk a ton about the majority decision, other than to say, what Justice Kagan essentially does is she sidesteps the issue in the case, which is the provision I read before, is this grant of authority to the Attorney General, is it too broad, too much authority, and essentially lawmaking authority to an executive branch official? And she does that in what, I mean, we've seen this kind of thing in the Supreme Court and other courts. It's kind of a judicial sleight of hand. She says, okay, if Gundy were correct that this was unbridled discretion in the AG, then maybe we'd have a delegation problem. But he's not correct because we're going to construe this law. No, that's true. That's actually a really good point.
She doesn't even say we'd have a non-delegation problem.
Yes, we might have a question, but there's really not a question because we can construe this act narrowly. And the way she does that, simply put, is she imposes a kind of feasibility requirement on what the Attorney General, when the Attorney General has to issue guidelines or specify what the requirements are for pre-act offenders. And it's really not much more than saying, okay, so yeah, that language is broad, but we'll read it to mean the AG has to issue guidelines as soon as feasible or as soon as practicable, which in my mind, I'm not really sure why that narrows the so-called intelligible principle or makes it an intelligible principle, but leaving that aside, she kind of sidesteps it. There's more that one can say about that, and we can discuss it, but I think the real interesting part of the decision to discuss is the Gorsuch dissent for a number of reasons, not the least of which is we have three of the conservative justices willing to rethink entirely from the ground up the non-delegation doctrine. If we assume that Kavanaugh would side with them, maybe that's a big assumption, but one hopes that he would, and then Alito would be willing to revisit it. We have a five-justice majority for significantly pulling back on the authority of the government, of Congress, to delegate to other branches of government. Now, let's ask just a couple quick practical questions, and then we can dig into two questions for both of you, whoever wants to take this up. One, why didn't the court hold the case over, if anybody has views on this, to be re-argued when Justice Kavanaugh got on the bench? That's the first question. And then secondly, and also interesting, why did Alito concur in the judgment as opposed to siding with the dissenters? Do you have views on this?
Well, in terms of the first question, I think it's a very good question because there were a couple of cases that the court had argued when Justice Kavanaugh had not been confirmed yet. And the other one was Nick v. Town of Scott. And the court did re-argue that one later in the term and issued a 5-4 decision at the end of the term, joined by Kavanaugh, to overturn the Williamson County decision. This was a very, very significant property rights decision. So it's difficult to look at those two opportunities and think that there isn't something up. Because clearly they were willing to re-argue the one case. They weren't willing to re-argue the other case. I don't think we know why. I think that it's the Supreme Court, rather by design, is something of a black box. But I do think that we can't take Justice Kavanaugh's position on this issue for granted, whether it's because Justice Alito wasn't really going to flip in this case or because Justice Kavanaugh wasn't prepared to join or because Chief Justice Roberts didn't want to have two cases that were argued and then flipped 5-4 because he thought that would look too political for the court or something like that. I think these are all possibilities, but we don't really know.
Yeah. David, anything to add to that?
No.
But you do, I presumably, or I'll just ask if you guys agree with me, that this is an issue very much in play. And the significance, it's a huge issue. So if you think about our giant administrative state, we have administrative agencies now, I think definitely pass more laws that actually affect individual conduct than Congress does, certainly at the federal level.
And the thing that struck me, Judge Rao on the D.C. Circuit had been the administrator of the Office of Information and Regulatory Affairs in the Trump administration before joining the D.C. Circuit. She gave a speech at AEI about this time last year where she said every day that she was the administrator of OIRA, she learned about a new federal agency that she had never heard of before.
Right.
That's incredible. Frightening for someone who was an administrative law scholar and then becomes the head of OIRA to be constantly hearing about not just new laws, entire new agencies
I'm not surprised when I learn about a new agency because I'm not as expert as she is on that. But, that's surprising or that's interesting.
I would jump in and say that, I don't watch the court as closely as you people do, but my sense is that this Gundy case would not be the most politically palatable set of facts to invoke the delegation, non-delegation doctrine. It would be better to do it in a case where the defendants are more sympathetic.
I think that's a good point. But in any event, so giant administrative state, and this is one of the main pillars of the administrative state. It's one of the ways that we went from having a relatively small federal government to having a gigantic federal government, and not for nothing, one that most of the power is exercised by unelected bureaucrats. So this is a really big deal, and it would be huge, and earth shattering if they overturned as much as they could. Although I don't think they would go that far, but there are all kinds of things that that could happen in this case or in cases like this in the future. So anyway, let's talk about then Justice Gorsuch's dissent, because it raises a number of very interesting points.
Can I just say one thing before you jump into the dissent, Steve? I think folks talk about it being earth-shattering, but the thing to remember is that when the non-delegation, even though the court has not exercised the non-delegation doctrine with any amount of strength or in a significant case since the 1930s, it did so twice in the 1930s, once in a 9-0 decision and once in an 8-1 decision. The 9-0 decision was Schechter Poultry, the 8-1 decision was Panama Refining. And I think sometimes when people think, oh, these were 1930s decisions, this was back when you had the Four Horsemen and these were liberal law professors want to tell you that this was an activist period of the court when bad things were happening. But these two statutes were stricken down, or these two aspects, I think they were both aspects of the same statute, were stricken down 9-0 and 8-1. So this was not considered controversial at the time.
Right. Yeah, and that happens right at the time when you get this explosive growth in the federal government. Which is not, I think, surprising. And Justice Gorsuch actually talks a bit about that in his dissent. So let's turn to the Gorsuch dissent, because I think if we're trying to decide what happens in the future, that's what to look at. And he articulates a number of points against the plurality and against the non-delegation, or against delegations of authority by Congress to executive branch officials. I'm just going to sort of highlight what I think are kind of the main touchstones of his decision, and then I'll turn it over first to David to talk about some of those in detail. So I'll just put it like this. I think you can think of the Gorsuch dissent as having at least three components. The first part of his analysis, or the first thing that he does, is he takes a look at the structure of the Constitution, and in particular, popular sovereignty. Where does the power in the Constitution come from? He quotes the preamble to the Constitution, that the people, ordain and establish this Constitution, and then he looks at the unique role of Congress. He concludes from that Congress can't delegate its authority. Second question he asks is, okay, what is the test? How do we determine the difference between a proper grant of authority to other branches or allowing other branches to take certain kinds of actions that one might call legislative and an improper one? That's a difficult question. What's the test? That's the second question he asks, and he has a few things to say about that. And then finally, and probably least importantly, he discusses the majority decision, and essentially what he says is, look, this law, this is not a construction of a statute. It's not the court really construing a statute. What they did was rewrite the statute. They just imposed a restriction that is not in the law. This is nonsense. We're deluding ourselves. We shouldn't do this. We should really take on this issue head on. I mean, he does more. He talks about stare decisis. He talks about a few other things. But those are kind of the big signposts of his decision. Rather than me explaining all of the things he did, I'd like to hear from you guys on that. So, David, let me start with you. Let's start by talking about what I referred to as the structural issues, and I think you've alluded to this before. The source of authority in the Constitution and Congress's unique role, what does Gorsuch have to say about that?
He says in Part 2A of the opinion that Article 1 assigns legislative powers to Congress. Those powers that are given exclusively to Congress, Congress must exercise itself. It can't delegate those powers to anybody else. That's the non-delegation doctrine. But then, and this is the mystery of the opinion, is part 2B says, what's the test? Huh? He's already given us the test. You can't delegate the powers that are given exclusively to it. So what's going on here? Why does he have 2B in the opinion at all? Well, partly what he's doing in 2B is to define the exercise of the powers that are given to Congress versus the powers that are given to the executive or the judicial. So in other words, a power that's given exclusively to Congress is to make the laws regulating private conduct. Okay? And he goes on then to say that in 2B, that making those laws is a job for Congress, but finding the facts or interpreting those laws as opposed to applying them, that's a job for the executive and for the judicial. That's fine. That's just clarifying what's in 2A. But then he does something else in 2B, which is very tricky and I think very wrong, is he says, well, actually, Congress can delegate to agencies the power to make some of the laws if it's that's just to fill in the details. Huh? Where does this come from? How do we understand why he gives one answer and then a page or two later he gives a totally different answer? Here's what's going on is explained in a recent book, a really terrific book, I think, by Professor Lawrence Lessig of Harvard Law School. And the book is called Fidelity and Constraint. And what the book attempts to do is to set out a model for what has driven both conservative and liberal justices from Marbury versus Madison on, how they've gone about interpreting the Constitution. And what he's saying, what he means by fidelity here is fidelity to the meaning of the Constitution. That's obvious, right? If you're going to apply the Constitution, you ought to apply what it means. Where does the constraint come from? Well, his point is there are certain types of decisions that could undermine the legitimacy of the court and therefore its ability to enforce its judgments. So the court has to find a way of avoiding decisions that do that, even at the expense of not being true to the meaning. And he goes all the way back to Marbury to show that this has been going on consistently. It's not just liberals, it's not just conservatives. So that's what's going on. So Lessig does not apply this model to delegation. But I will, and I think it seems to me there are three constraints on the court.
Can I just hold you up there for 1 minute? We'll come back to that in a minute, but I want to unpack a little bit more just so everybody understands the first part. So the structural issue here and connecting this to the consent of the governed, let's unpack that just a little bit because it's not immediately obvious why it is that that Congress delegating its authority to administrative agencies somehow violates, let's you call it the constitutional norm, which you call it of consent of the governed. And Mark, maybe you can talk a little bit about this, because one of the things that you made the point earlier that we shouldn't call this non-delegation, we should call it divestment. And I agree with that completely. I think it's important to get the terms right, because
and Justice Gorsuch uses the
yes,
term divest
right.
Two or three times in his dissent, which we were very excited about.
Yeah, but unpack a little bit. What's the connection between that and consent of the governed, popular sovereignty? How is it that delegating is sort of cutting off, you know, the power of the people to consent to the type of government that they want?
Sure. Well, I think that we talked about bicameralism before, and I think that that's really what it boils down to. It would be hard to find a statute that was a clearer illustration of dodging bicameralism than SORNA. There were two separate bills working their way through the legislature. One was working its way through the House, one was working its way through the Senate. And one of those, and I can tell you in 1 second which one, the House version of SORNA applied to prior offenders. The Senate version did not apply to prior offenders. And when the House and the Senate versions came together, The final bill also did not apply to prior offenders. Instead, it took this dodge of assigning responsibility to the Attorney General to decide whether the statute was going to apply to prior offenders or not. So we know to a moral certainty that the SORNA bill could not, because it did not, gain assent in, or a version of it that would have applied to prior offenders could not and did not gain the assent of both houses of Congress. So bicameralism is supposed to make passing legislation difficult. In this case, Congress had more work to do, and rather than do that work or reach some other sort of compromise, they evaded the constitutional requirement of bicameralism and punted to the Attorney General, who then obliged and made it apply to both. So instead of the constitutional process of having both houses of Congress approve a criminal law and have the president sign on to it, now we have a system where, well, the House doesn't have to approve it, just the Senate has to approve it, and the House just has to agree to let the Attorney General decide whether or not to have the law. That's not the constitutional structure, and it evades, to David's point, accountability on the part of the elected officials.
Right. I want to disagree with you and your strategy and your labeling of things, because I think there's a smarter way.
Okay.
So, I mean, think about freedom of speech. Now, that's popular. People like that idea, right? What about non-delegation? How do we feel about that? Well, we don't even know what it means. You know, or to the extent you know what it means, you think it was only embraced by conservative kooks who don't want any regulation whatsoever, something like that, right? So not, and in fact, the court didn't use the term non-delegation until about 40 years ago, and they adopted it from scholars who wanted the doctrine to go away. Okay? Is divestment better? Well, I mean, what does divestment mean anyway to the average person? Or what is bicameralism? It's all inside baseball. Consent of the governed people get. I want to say in how my government works. I live in a republic. Government of the people, by the people, for the people. The name we ought to use here is the consent of the governed norm.
I want to dwell on that just for a minute, because I think there are two things going on that are sort of packed into the so-called structural part, what I've referred to as the structural part of Gorsuch's dissent. One is consent of the governed, and just to spell it out crystal clearly, if we accept the fact that the people delegate, so to speak, authority to the government, or the people create the Constitution through the founders, and that the whole idea of constitutional legitimacy has to begin with the consent of the people to govern themselves, and they create this government, and then they hand over limited powers to the government. They don't hand over all the power they could hand over to it. One of the framers' deep points that they get from Locke and other thinkers is you have to have a connection then between lawmaking and people consenting to what the laws are going to be. And that comes out through Congress bicameralism.
It comes out from the legislators having to take personal responsibility for the trade-offs.
Right.
That is the key thing.
And if they can hand their authority over to administrators, now there is this fiction, I think, that the court often resorts to when it's talking about both deference doctrines and non-delegation, which is they'll say, well, okay, sure, so administrative agencies are not as subject to the will of the people, but they're certainly more so than courts. And therefore, we can't really overrule an administrative agency because that would be counter-majoritarian. It would destroy representative government. But somehow they engage the fiction that agencies are open or responsible to the people. Let me just ask you guys. I mean, I think that's nonsense. But what is your view of that? That just strikes me as crazy. I don't think administrative agencies are any more open to, probably less so to the people and public opinion than even the courts at times.
I mean, I think the political science literature is really strong that this Congress is more responsible to the public than the agencies.
And I think, David, you cite in one of your articles polls that say that the people actually would prefer to be governed by Congress if they have a choice
between
agencies.
There was a poll that was taken in January of this year, and the overwhelming majority of the people agree with the proposition Congress should vote on the regulations. By a margin of 4-1 among Republicans, and guess what the proportion is among Democrats? 4-1, right? Among independents, 5-1, but the behavior of Congress is unanimous. We don't want to be responsible for any of it. So this is not a Democratic voter versus Republican voter issue. This is a politician versus voter issue. And when we, well, I'm going to get back to what I was talking about here, but I think there's hope on delegation, and the hope comes from the fact that the public wants these people we elect to take responsibility. That's the hope. Because the court's problem is basically a political problem, is it's afraid that if it makes a ruling here, it will become despised and therefore no longer legitimate. But the hope here is for the court to harness the public support for congressional responsibility. And I want to get into how that could, they could do that.
Okay. Well, let me why don't we turn to I'd like to talk a little bit about what Gorsuch says is the test and whether we think that's realistic or
That by talking about his constraints. Because I think these are the constraints that I derive from Lessig that explain why the court has been loath to enforce the norm, the consent of the government norm, for so long. First constraint is this. It's impossible for Congress to do it. You know, our society has too many darn rules for Congress to vote on them all. And, you know, the court reached that conclusion in 1825 in Wayman versus Southard. You know? And that's where they came up with the fill up the details language, that Congress could leave the minor regulations to the to somebody else, because I think they felt there was just, they couldn't enforce this thing altogether, so they'd let the little stuff go, okay? But the fill up the details minor regulation language wasn't good enough to the court, let's say in the middle of the Depression, because now things that were clearly not details were being decided by New Deal agencies. So that's when they came up with this intelligible principle thing. Okay? Okay. So that's one constraint. Too many rules. You've got to find a way of making, if your Congress can only do so many of them, make them do the important ones. Okay. Two, the second constraint, judicial manageability. The judicial manageability, in other words, you need a test that sounds judicial, that feels judicial. Because if you don't have such a test, the court comes across as political, right? And clearly, intelligible principle flunks the test. Nobody, and that's what the court holds. Nobody knows what it means, so we're not going to enforce it, okay? Now, but what Gorsuch says the Constitution means, which is Congress must exercise the legislative powers, that is intelligible. Okay? The problem is how do you carve off these lesser regulations that really don't, the Congress really can't handle. So if we use go back to the 1825 Wayman versus Southard exception or carve-out, which is fill up the details, that worked okay in 1825. I mean, because there wasn't that much going on in the federal government. But today, I mean, imagine what would have happened if Gorsuch was writing the majority opinion in Gundy. Okay, this is struck down because Congress, the power they gave to the Attorney General was more than filling in the details. Okay. Now, every public interest group, every regulated firm is going to say, this regulation that affects me, is that a detail or not? And you got this huge code of federal regulations. Nobody's knowing what they got to do. I mean, there will be absolute pandemonium in the country. So what's Congress going to do at that point? There's no dial thing you could go on your iPhone and say, what's the detail, right? So the only thing I can imagine Congress doing after that type of Gundy decision would be to pass a statute enacting the entire code of federal regulations. Now, what does that do for consent of the government? I mean, that is nuts, right? Okay. So the court would make itself look totally stupid if the court did what Gorsuch said it should do. Right? Okay. So
Can I jump in just on that point?
Yeah.
I think, and we can get into to what an intelligible principle might look like in terms of a future test or something. I think it would have been extremely easy in this case, because I think that the majority opinion could have said there was never a meeting of the minds between the House and the Senate on this point.
Oh, that's absolutely true, but that's true of everything else in the, just about everything else in the Code of Federal Regulations. The problem isn't that you could make this look like something that's not filling in the details.
The problem is the
uncertainty that would follow from that.
But there's a big difference between, I think most of the details you're talking about are details that aren't even really talked about in the legislation to begin with. But this was a particular, whether or not to apply this statute to offenders who are already incarcerated, pre-act offenders, was one of the biggest bones of contention in the Congress when this legislation was being debated, and Congress never decided it.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't have any problem. I'm not arguing with you that what would, you know, if I was judge, I wouldn't have a problem thinking this is not a detail. The problem is how do you know about the rest of the Code of Federal Regulations?
Yeah,
that's
sure.
And that's huge.
But that's for the next case.
No, it isn't, because the chaos would begin immediately. Okay? So, in other words, before the court
gets... Or Congress taking responsibility for itself would begin immediately.
Well, yeah. But the thing is, given that we already have this huge Code of Federal Regulation, and so much business planning and so much state and local government planning depends upon knowing which part of that is good and which part of that is bad, which part is valid, which part is invalid, it would be just mayhem, right? So I'm trying to say is that before the court makes a decision in this area, it has to be fairly clear about the criteria that are going to apply to in the future and so what the likely results are going to be, okay? And I think that leads to the third constraint, which is that the court can't do anything which is wildly unpopular that's going to cause a big enough reaction of opinion. And what Lessig says about this is a constraint that by its very nature the court can't talk about, but it does bend to all the time. Okay, so in the New Deal, when there was all the panic about the Depression and all that, the court, even after Panama refining and Schechter, it just bent, right? And
right, those were 1935 cases. The court bent in 1937.
I agree. Okay, so what I'm trying to say today is that the concern that the court cannot come across as being anti-regulatory protection. Okay. Even the people who say they hate bureaucrats want regulatory protection. And so that's why Kagan says, oh, they're going to tear down the administrative state. And what Gorsuch says is, no, I'm not. He doesn't say that in so many words, but he's saying he has a defense to that. Congress could get the agencies to draft the regulations, and then Congress could vote on them. Apparently, Gorsuch has not heard of gridlock. Right? I mean, this is not a realistic response to what the problem of how the system is going to work in the future. Okay, so.
But you can imagine a system where regulations that had a value of over $100 million or something like that got voted on.
That's just what I've imagined. And thank you very much. You're being very nice. There is a way that Congress could do exactly what you're saying, and it was invented by, guess who, James Landis, the New Deal's guru in administrative law, then dean at Harvard Law School, who in 1938 published a book with Yale Press in which he said that what Congress should provide is that new significant regulations, not all the regulations, but the significant ones should not go into effect unless Congress votes for them. And then there was another dude that came along. His name was Stephen Breyer. He was a judge at this point in 1984. And he wrote an article saying that there's a way you could deal with this in an era where Congress may be gridlocked, though I don't think he used that word. and that is that you'd set deadline. It would be like the base closing statute, fast-track legislation, deadline for the House to vote, deadline for the Senate to vote, no amendments, two-hour debate, no filibuster. They voted up or down. There's a roll call vote. That's accountability, roll call vote. That's what we want, okay? So that could work. And as to the cutoff, there's an executive order that's been in force under two Democratic presidents and two Republican presidents that makes the cutoff $100 million a year in annual costs. You got a definition, you got an institution that...
Those rules are already reported to OIRA within the executive branch process, so
exactly.
It's easy to identify them.
Yeah. Now, the thing is, this idea comes from Landis and Breyer, two Democrats, right? But the Democrats have not introduced any such bill. The Republicans have introduced a bill called RAINS, Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny, that includes this idea, but other ideas that are not pro-accountability but anti-regulation. Therefore, no Democrat will support it. It's never going to pass anything like the current Congress. It didn't pass the prior Congress when Republicans were in charge. So the Republicans can say they're for being responsible but never have to take responsibility.
But can I just interrupt real quick and say, it sounds like we're talking about two different, there are two issues going on. One is, if the court were to pull back on the broad delegation of authority to the administrative state, what is the principle or what is the test that the court should adopt? And the second question, which strikes me as separate from that, is, and then what could Congress and the executive branch do, or what should they do to deal with the aftermath of that? That is, to put it a different way, this doesn't sound like the kind should be doing.
In other words, I want to address that. Okay. So, first of all, I'm going to take first, what should Congress do? Well, what Lessig says is just because a constitutional norm is not judicially enforceable, is it right for Congress to ignore it or flaunt it? And so Congress, whatever the court does, Congress has a moral obligation, a duty, to comply with the consent of the government norm to the extent it could, and clearly it's paying no attention to that. As for the court, ought to enforce the meaning of the Constitution to the extent it's not constrained. Okay. So the question is there some way or another that the court could enforce the consent of the government norm to a substantial extent? Okay. So let's imagine one scenario, which is, by the way, it's not going to work, but I'm just going to run it out for you to see what the problem is. Let's say the court issues some kind of order somehow or another, I don't know how they do it, saying, okay, you guys in Congress, you've got to adopt Landis-Breyer, and we're going to apply it, and it's going to have to apply to every statute, every regulation that costs more than $100 million a year. Well, that is not going to fly because it looks so darn political. I mean, here's an issue that's been in Congress. The court's dictating to Congress how it's legislated. It's deciding which statutes are too big or too small to qualify. It can't do that, right? And so, in other words, because it just looks too much like policy and not enough like law. On the other hand, the institution that's legitimately can make policy choices, Congress doesn't want to make a choice. Okay. But the court has faced problems like that in other areas, like one person, one vote. Let's say you have a state which has a badly malapportioned legislature. The court does not step into this one by immediately saying, okay, this is how we're going to redistrict the state legislature. What they do is they say, okay, you're malapportioned, you've got 3 years to reapportion. And if you don't, we'll do it. Right? So it doesn't look like the court's hungry to take on policy choices, but if it's necessary to do that, to enforce the Constitution, we will. But we've given you every chance. And even if we reapportion, if you come up with another apportionment that's compliant with the Constitution, that's all right, too. Okay? So they could do the similar kind of thing with delegation. They could say, okay, in this particular case, the regulation is very important, and there's no guidance from Congress. It's invalid, it violates the Constitution, but we're not going to give any relief immediately. what we're going to do is say that from 2 years hence, or whatever the period is, if a regulation is significant in the sense of being, unless you could show us that the cost per year is less than $100 million, it's going to be invalid unless it's voted on by Congress. Okay? That puts the ball in Congress's court. Now, what's Congress going to do? Well, first of all, neither the public interest groups nor the industries are going to want to have a situation where you can't change any regulations. They want to be able to change, to adapt, number one. Number two, the voters by 4-1, 5-1, want Congress to be responsible. Number three, now there's a hammer over Congress's head. I think there's a pretty darn good chance that Congress is going to buckle. And so I think that's the way out of this trap we've gotten ourselves
into. Why, though? I mean, I don't necessarily disagree with you from the standpoint of what Congress should be doing in reaction to a Supreme Court decision that strikes down significant laws on non-delegation grounds. I wonder whether it strikes me as odd and just not what court should be doing to, in effect, be directing Congress, now you have to take certain steps. I don't see why they couldn't do this as just, this law is unconstitutional, even if we can't articulate a test for all time, because it's very difficult. And this is part of the issue with Gorsuch's dissent, is that the broad structural principles that he announces is wonderful, great, I love it, it's great. But as an attorney, as a, you know, somebody who is appreciates the difficulty that judges face, I want to know what the test is. Okay, so how do we figure this out? Now, I think that's both a weakness, you could call it a weakness in Gorsuch's dissent, but it's an unavoidable one, so I'm not even sure I would call it a weakness. And we've long heard that part of the reason that the court doesn't want to draw these lines is it's hard to figure out where the line is. Okay, fine. So it's hard to distinguish between
legislation. But it wasn't hard in this case.
No, that's true, and that's exactly what I'm getting at, is what's wrong with a rule of law or an approach that the court takes that essentially says we're going to take this one step at a time. We're going to take it piecemeal. We can't articulate one principle that answers every single, or yeah, we could do it. It would be no delegation at all. You want us to do that? We'll do that. They're not going to do that, I don't think. But what's wrong with an essentially piecemeal approach in a context in which it is very difficult to find a principle that answers every single case?
Well, there was a law professor by the name of Antonin Scalia. And around 1980, he wrote an essay in which he said, a note on the benzene case it was called, and he said, you know, the intelligible principle test is not really judicially manageable, but why doesn't the court just take one case and strike down that regulation, right? Well, when he got on the court, he came nowhere near that, okay? And I think the reason why is that throwing that one bomb is going to do exactly what I told you before it's going to do, is it's going to make everybody in the world wonder what part of the Code of Federal Regulations is any good and what part isn't. And, let me finish the thought. That, so it's going to make planning and all that and just knowing where you stand so very uncertain.
Certainly it would do so within the Beltway. I'm not sure if it would do so within or outside of the confines.
Well, I mean, you read Philip Howard, you read Peter Wallace, and they'll all tell you, you know, everybody in the world, you know, I mean, you take your average dentist office, there's like 500 federal regulations that regulate it.
Yeah.
You know? And so, I mean, the point is that this might have worked in, you know, 1830 or something like that, but we've now built up such an edifice that runs, that affects everything, that you just can't. And the nice thing about my approach is
I don't think the rule would do it all at once. I think the rule would invite additional challenges to additional statutes, and in a judicially incremental way over time, the worst statutes would get struck down, and the ones closer to the line probably wouldn't get five votes to overturn.
No, the court would go at it slowly, but you know, let's say you've got a particular regulation that you've got to comply with, or you're hoping you want to have valid because you want this protection. How many, you know, when you go to your lawyer and say to the lawyer, how soon will we have a definitive answer as to whether this regulation is valid or not? 7, 8, 10 years, you know? Mm-hmm. So there's going to be years of chaos for the average person.
I just don't see it, David, because in the planning context, you, the law is what the law is today, and you can plan on that. You can't, you're not going to be held liable for complying with current law. If that regulation, and in almost all cases, you'd be talking about regulations that go too far, right, that intrude too much on liberty. So I think most businesses who are complying with those rules and regulations, if those, if they found out over time that, oh, well, we don't have to comply with that one or that one or that one, it's not going to upset the apple cart that much. They may just continue to comply with them anyway. They aren't.
Well, let's say you're building a new plant, you know, and you're trying to figure out what how you want to go about doing it, you know, and so which of these requirements in building the new plant am I going to have to comply with or not? It's gonna so that type of process is going to become, well, I think I just better put it off for a few years till this thing gets sorted out.
I wonder if that would happen, and I wonder if, at the very least, I mean, so 2 points. One, we talk about responsibility, Congress taking responsibility. I mean, another issue of responsibility that I think we need to work into the discussion, me, big picture, we being those of us who are concerned about this issue, is people taking responsibility for their own lives. I mean, that's what freedom is all about. And there is that, you know, that other component, which I like to think of the real world out there, outside of the Beltway, in which people are operating and making choices. And yeah, maybe people have to learn what it's like to continue to make the kind of choices or make the kind of choices to take responsibility for their own lives and govern their own affairs, which is certainly part of what the framers were after. But to your point about uncertainty, I don't know that we have more certainty now with delegation than we would have without it. Because, I mean, this case is a good example. So Justice Gorsuch points out that I think three attorney generals, you had three different rules. And this was a broad delegation to them. Okay, you guys figure out what the rules are. And they all decided different things. And over the space of, what, 6, 7 years, you had three different rules. I mean, that happens constantly. We see that with guidance. We see that with all of the various deference doctrines. It's not as though administrative agencies are issuing a concrete, you know, clear rule that everybody knows how to follow, and then that just remains the case for a long period of time.
Well, and it's not just the administrative agencies, Steve, because one of the things Gorsuch talks about in his dissent is that the court has used different strategies in lieu of non-delegation in order to constrain some of these statutes. So he talked about the marked increase in void for vagueness cases,
right,
that you didn't see those,
yes,
you know, 75 years ago.
And, not many of those, though.
Well,
there's been a
he said marked increase. And,
well, that's true, and, but still not
as well
many.
As the more recent major questions doctrine, where the court now says, well, we're not going to assume that there's a delegation if it's a significant issue if it's an issue of political significance and salience, then we're not going to readily assume that Congress has delegated that decision making to the executive branch. Let me just finish this point. And I think that in this very case, Justice Kagan supplied another strategy in the majority opinion itself, which is rewriting the statute to read out any non-delegation concern. Because the truth of the matter is, after she has rewritten the statute, there isn't a non-delegation problem in the statute anymore. But the problem I have is that rewriting the statute isn't in the court's power to do. And so you were talking earlier about the court worrying about its illegitimacy by going too far. Well, to me, the court avoids striking down a statute as a violation of the non-delegation doctrine or the divestment clause of Article 1, Section 1. And yet that would have been within the court's legitimate power to do. But instead, Justice Kagan has rewritten the statute, or if I were being more charitable, I would say that sub silentio, she has created a very strong canon of constitutional avoidance by construing a statute not to contain an unconstitutionally broad delegation to the Attorney General. But that is more illegitimate than just applying Article 1, Section 1.
Yeah, isn't the legitimacy point, it's an unavoidable issue, and it cuts either way. So either we're being So you want to say or be concerned about the court's legitimacy. The court has to face the legitimacy question no matter which way it goes on this question. It's either going to undermine constitutional legitimacy, what the Constitution properly does, or it's going to be accused of essentially going too far taking too much on that Congress might otherwise have to deal with. I don't see how that's an avoidable issue.
I mean, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that the Attorney General was allowed to create 500,000 felons.
Yeah, that's
here.
Right.
Now, I think David's right that folks aren't necessarily, don't find sexual offenders. I mean, Gundy was a child rapist. This is about the least sympathetic character you could identify. But some of the folks, some of the 500,000 people who are being affected by this law were much less serious offenders that may have been teens doing things with other teens, what have you. And the idea that the Attorney General can create 500,000 felons is a problem. We see the same thing with, and Steve, you know this because you've been litigating this case, with the bump stock ban, that the Attorney General passes a new regulation and tries to make bump stocks illegal by regulation, not by statute. Again, another 500,000 felons created overnight by an Attorney General regulation. 500,000 here, 500,000 there. Pretty soon you have millions of people who are being created as felons without Congress acting.
Right.
And
yeah,
I think that's a problem of legitimacy for the court.
Yeah, there's no question about that. I mean, you know, I don't like the type of statute we have here, and I don't like the fact that the Attorney General is changing who's defined as a felon. So, I mean, it's not like the administrative state is throwing up vast certainty, but you're adding, you know, but the kind of approach you guys are advocating adds a whole other level of uncertainty to it. And the problem isn't just the uncertainty, there's a problem of, I mean, I think you guys are talking about judicial legitimacy in the sense of, are they staying true to the Constitution? Well, anytime they're being moved by one of Lessig's constraints, they're not being true to the Constitution. That's by definition. But on top of that, there's the political legitimacy. There's how the court looks to the public. And to the extent, politicians and public interest groups could say, they've threatened the whole thing. What part of all these protections you have are to protect your family from various poisons? What part are going to be in effect 5 years from now? They're turning the whole thing down, right? It really could be that there'd be a wave against the court that the court could not withstand. And that's Lessig's point here. I mean, he's not talking about delegation, but I mean, that's the reason for the constraint. And I think you've got to take the constraint seriously. And it seems to me the whole history of the non-delegation doctrine shows a tremendous concern with those constraints. So there are many ways that the court has paid attention to delegation. Void for vagueness, as you point out. I'd say Clinton versus New York and Chadha are non-delegation cases too. But they don't want to use the name because the concept has become politically suspect. So the court needs to find a way of turning the ship of state, and it's a big one at this point, in a way that preserves the court's legitimacy, that makes people feel they're still going to be protected, and that the world is not too uncertain.
I mean, there's no question, in my view, and Mark, feel free to chime in here, that the court does take political account or its role in government and its own legitimacy seriously in the sense in which you're talking about. That they are definitely worried about, and I think Justice Roberts probably foremost among them in this respect, very worried about how the court is perceived and whether it's perceived as a legitimate institution.
Right.
And that definitely cabins how far they're willing to go. So that's just a real phenomenon. That's a real thing about the court. But if I were a justice on the court, yes, I would be concerned about that. But at the same time, if I'm in Justice Gorsuch's shoes or on the dissent side of this, I'm also very worried about constitutional legitimacy and recognize that, okay, we're in a situation here where we have gone so far beyond what the Constitution allows. And we are either going to keep going in that direction, which means more and more and more rules, more ceding of authority to administrative agencies, more of what Naomi Rao pointed out, which is nobody even knows who is doing all of this. I don't see that stopping unless somebody puts a stop on or starts to put the brakes on. So the question is, how do they do that? I tend to come out with, how, without having, you know, thought this through totally, that we got here through incrementalism, the way back is through incrementalism, and the court does have to do something like start striking down laws and start saying, okay, well, listen, enough is enough, or this is too far. I'm not going to say what is always too far, but this is too far.
In Power Without Responsibility, I took a position which is farther along than yours. I mean, more absolute.
You're more radical like me.
Yeah. Well, I'm older now.
That's right. Give Steve time.
Right.
I took the position that the court should stop all delegation of lawmaking authority. All. And no out for fill in the details. The whole thing. And what I reasoned was this way, is that allowing delegation created incentives for Congress to regulate in much more complex ways, that if there was no delegation whatsoever, they would either through leaving issues to the states or through market-based approaches be able to do anything that they needed to do to get there, to have a reasonable level of protection and still comply with the Constitution. Okay? Now, I'm not sure that, you know, if we could actually roll the clock back and a couple of centuries, I'm not sure that's wrong. But the point is this. That now that we got this apparatus around us, the administrative state, the court trying to get there either in one leap or incrementally, I just think it's just too much politically. It's the third constraint. It's the constraint of you can't rile up the people too much. And that's what Lessig says was going on with Marbury. He figured out a way around what was otherwise a very unpopular result. So I'm sympathetic to what you're saying, but the point is, I think at this day and age, the court cannot take a no delegation whatsoever position.
And Gorsuch doesn't take that position.
Absolutely
go ahead,
right.
Go ahead,
yes.
Mark.
Well, I was just going to say that, you know, I think that part of the path forward here needs to be to take this debate out of the ideological sphere, and I think that David's move to talk about Professor Landis and then Judge Breyer's views is important, and I think that one of the things that we're trying to do at the New Civil Liberties Alliance is to make it clear that these objections aren't rooted in some sort of political libertarianism. They're rooted in the Constitution itself, and that and Justice Gorsuch says this in his dissent that words to the effect that respecting the non-delegation doctrine does not say anything about the proper size and scope of government. You could still have all of the various agencies and rules that we have. They just have to be voted on by Congress, not created without Congress's involvement by the executive branch.
Yeah, but given gridlock and everything else, you know, wishing isn't going to make it so. And so, let me finish the point. Please. I'm your guest. So I think the point I'm making is that what the court ought to do is throw the ball back in Congress's lap as to how to do this, and that would give the court a lot more legitimacy to the public, and it would be a lot easier on the court than trying to do it through incremental judicial decisions.
But isn't an incremental judicial decision precisely what throws each statute back into Congress's lap?
Yeah. I think they ought to do it the way they did with legislative districting, reapportionment, is say, okay, you got so many years to figure out what you're going to do. Otherwise, this is the approach we're going to take. And then and my suggested approach would be for new regulations that cost more than $100 million a year. So that's a bright line. And you're not threatening the existing CRFR, you're talking about the future. That does not create the type of uncertainty, I think, that would be so alarming to so many people.
Yeah,
And Congress is perfectly free to come up with another approach as long as the court thinks it's a substantial effort to comply with Article 1. And if the court does end up having to carry through on the threat, Congress could always come along with something. And as long as the court says it substantially complies with Article 1, fine. So put the blame on those SOBs in Congress, because they're the ones who deserve it.
So I want to come back to something that Steve said earlier, and that we got into this mess incrementally, and maybe we need to get out of it incrementally as well. And point out that the court, and I would just invite everyone to read Justice Gorsuch's dissent, at least that portion of it that goes into the history of how we got where we are, because it makes for fascinating reading. But the particular piece I want to pull out is that the court first used the phrase intelligible principle in 1928. So it was pre-Depression when this term was thrown out, and it was Chief Justice Taft, former President Taft, who used this phrase. And what Justice Gorsuch says in his dissent is that no one at the time thought that the phrase meant to affect some revolution in the court's understanding of the Constitution. So it's not as though the phrase intelligible principle was given new meaning in 1928. Taft used that to refer to a whole series of previous decisions over the past 100 years that did constrain what the legislature could hand over to the executive. And so I think that there's a rich body of Supreme Court precedent on what the legislature is allowed to do and what it isn't allowed to do. Unfortunately, a lot of that rich history ends in about 1935, but Taft was evoking a long-standing understanding that the court had. And so as opposed to something that where the court might be doing something out of whole cloth, it's really recovering or would be rediscovering a constitutional principle here. And so I think that there actually would be a ton of constitutional legitimacy in doing it, and I think there would be quite a bit of popular support for it.
I have to disagree. I mean, first of all, there weren't that many pre-1928 cases. Beyond that, the cases from 1819 to 1928, I mean, this was the progressive era. And these people thought that, the progressives thought that if you hand over a decision to an expert agency, insulated from politics, they thought these agencies were insulated from politics back then, that these people would be making scientific decisions, so they weren't really making law, they were applying law using science. I mean, it's a crock of garbage, right?
So the
point is the decisions were based on fantasy, right?
But the court wasn't a progressive court. I mean, you're right that the legislature was a progressive legislature, and the President Wilson
wasn't just Wilson.
Yeah. Roosevelt before that, but sticking with Wilson for just a minute, I mean, if you want to get into the history of it, the real history is that Wilson saw that women were getting the right to vote, that minorities were getting the right to vote, and he didn't trust that women and minorities would make the right decisions if the Congress continued to have the power to make these decisions. So it was a very deliberate decision on his part to take power away from the legislative branch and try to put it into the executive branch where white men could continue to make the decisions for the country. That was what Woodrow, and Wilson was very explicit about this. This isn't me reading
into
Wilson's
psychology. And this is J.P. Morgan as well. It was the big business people as well. They all felt that power ought to be exercised by people like them. I just don't think those cases provide that much garbage, that much guidance for what's going on now.
Well, so I think, Steve, you started to ask the question, what should an intelligible principle, test look like? And Gorsuch, he adumbrates that to a certain extent, but he really doesn't get into a great deal of detail. He does say that if the legislature conditions the legislation on the finding of certain facts by the executive branch, for example, that would be a fine. And he says that if you're...
But that's really right within... That's totally constitutionally legitimate.
Yes.
No problem with that.
Yep, okay. Absolutely.
Okay.
And he also says that if you're dealing with something that's already an executive function, like foreign policy,
right,
then... There's a lot more room to leave the executive to fill in the details. But I would just come back to, in this particular case, I don't think it was difficult to recognize, looking at the legislative back and forth between the House and the Senate, that there was never a meeting of the minds between the House and the Senate on whether this legislation should apply to pre-act offenders. And therefore, this would have been the time for the Supreme Court to say, hey, wait a minute, whatever we've said before about the non-delegation doctrine, at a minimum, you can't escape bicameralism, you can't escape the consent of the governed, to use David's terminology, by punting things to the executive branch.
I'm going to agree, but go ahead.
Well, maybe I should defer to you. Why don't you go ahead, and I'll come back and make
I would just I say that, that if we're going to have a fill-in-the-details test, I don't have any problem saying that SORNA flunks the test. The problem is how it applies to the rest of the CFR,
which is not an easy issue. Mark, did you have another thing to say?
Well, just that that when you're... when you're getting around bicameralism, that it's not just that you're taking power away from the people and away from the consent of the governed, but you're also doing something that is a problem for the legislature itself, which is it's a well-understood principle that one Congress can't bind a future Congress unless it passes a statute and, you know, goes through bicameralism and presentment under the Constitution. But what you're effectively doing when you allow one Congress, and we see this all the time right now, this is one of Congress's favorite tricks, is for one Congress to take some issue, hand it over to the executive branch, and say, well, the executive branch needs to regulate in this area. And then a future Congress, its hands are tied in being able to undo that. And we've seen that with Obamacare. We've seen it with a lot of significant pieces of legislation, yeah, where one Congress is essentially getting away with binding a future Congress by delegating all sorts of legislative power to the executive branch. And so we didn't really talk about that constitutional problem, but that's very much happening.
I agree.
All the time right now.
I agree.
So I want to leave time for audience questions, but let me just quickly ask one final question of you two, and I'll put it as what does the future hold, but a little more concretely, what are your predictions and or what sort of a case would you like to see tee up this issue? I mean, and if you don't know, it's fine.
I've spoke to what I think the court ought to do, and I think it's conceivable that it could be a non-delegation case, but I mean, what I'm really asking for is for the court to put the ball back in the lap of Congress. It could do that even in the course of deciding a Chevron-related case, because Chevron, after all, is about delegation. And so it could be in the course of that decision saying, hey, Congress, guess what's coming down the road? So it could be a straightforward delegation case or a Chevron case.
And I guess I'd like to see a case where there's a more sympathetic plaintiff and where it's not in the criminal context. I would have thought before this case that the criminal context would have been the place to start because you have the rule of lenity and other principles that suggest that the court should go in that direction. But I think Justice Alito has maybe shown his colors here, and he's going to be harder to get on the criminal cases than he would be on a case that was outside the criminal context. Yeah.
All right, with that, let's go to audience questions. You here with the red tie.
Hi, two quick questions. The first, at my suggestion, the federal defender has filed a petition for rehearing in this case. What do you think the odds are that the court will grant rehearing now that Kavanaugh can help break the split?
Zero.
Okay. And I don't understand why you think that the non-delegation, the idea of non-delegation, or at least that term, is so modern. Justice Story quoted English common law doctrine, a Latin doctrine, translated in English means delegated power may not be delegated, and that was in 1833.
That's a different concept. The idea that delegated power can't be delegated, that's a sub-delegation. That's a different, that's also... That's an agency principle that is also true and well regarded, but that's not the same as the non-delegation doctrine in the constitutional context. The rule in the constitutional context isn't that once Congress delegates to the agency, they can't delegate it any further. That's not what the non-delegation doctrine is. So I'm not saying that Justice Story never thought of this idea, because I think the founders thought of this idea. It was in Article 1, Section 1.
wondering what your reaction is to the following actual situation. Congress has enacted a comprehensive regulatory statute governing the sale and use of pesticides, vested EPA with authority to implement it. The statute's been around for a long time. The agency has commenced a statutorily required, scientifically based review of a particular chemical. A group of 100 or more House Democrats don't like the direction that the currently administered EPA is taking with that review. So they've sponsored or co-sponsored a bill that would simply ban the chemical immediately, and in so doing, cut off all of the administrative appeal rights that the statute provides to interested parties. From a constitutional viewpoint, I'm assuming you would not have a problem with that.
Correct.
Correct.
That you might have with it.
Well, so I can give you a real world. This may be a real world example too that I'm just not familiar with, Larry. But when I was at the Consumer Product Safety Commission, we had almost this exact situation come up where Congress had passed a law where it prohibited three phthalates, and then there were three other phthalates where it said no, the agency needs to go and look at these and make a convene a chronic hazard advisory panel and decide whether or not these chemicals are should also be banned or not. And the to make a very long story short, there's no constitutional problem with, I think, what happened there. I mean, Congress just banned three of them outright, and that was within Congress's prerogative. The three that it handed to the agency to decide, the agency completely botched. And it took a long time to do it, but botched it thoroughly in the end. And they were supposed to use the most current science, and there were all these sort of statutory things that they needed to do that they chose to disregard. And I suspect what will happen in that case is that there actually is a lawsuit pending in the Fifth Circuit. I forget exactly where it is in the process. But I think that'll eventually work its way out. In the case that you give of where the legislature gets tired of the process along the way and says, so if in this case Congress had just said, you know what, you're taking forever on this chap, we're just going to ban the other three.
Or doesn't like the result.
It's within Congress's purview, and it's also within the voters' prerogative to vote people out who are not proceeding according to the dictates of science.
Just one point on the last question. The executive would have to, decide to approve the bill or veto it in that case. So that would be a protection that the agency and the parties have. But in any event, my question is, where do you think Justice Thomas stands right now? Because in the Amtrak case, he articulated a version of the non-delegation doctrine that was very muscular, and that would essentially say every time you have an agency regulating private conduct, except maybe in the foreign affairs context, you're basically violating the Constitution. And now he's joining this opinion by Gorsuch, which says, fill up the details. So do you think Thomas has sort of given in to the practical realities of the non-delegation doctrine and the modern administrative state, or where do you think he stands at the moment?
Well, one thing that makes the Amtrak case tricky is that you essentially had a situation where Amtrak was being given the power to regulate all of its competitors, and not competitors in the sense of other passenger rail, but competitors for the use of the track. That was really what the issue was. You have all of the privately held railroads who want access to the rail network for shipping purposes, and Amtrak was getting to dictate terms of use on the rails. And so I think that was probably my, and I'm guessing here, that Justice Thomas would see that as even worse than the kind of situation you would see in other non-delegation areas. So I don't know that you can necessarily look at those two and look for much inconsistency between them, because I think one is a much worse instance of not just empowering the Amtrak to be the regulator, but empowering it specifically to regulate its competitors in a way that's pretty pernicious.
I just say to that it seems to me the position that Justice Thomas was taking in the rail case is enforcing the meaning of the Constitution without regard to the constraints, which is what I did in my book, and he cites me there. I've changed some, and it seems to me he's changed some, too.
Well, Justice Gorsuch cites you. Is he citing your current you or the old you?
Old me.
Both.
Well, basically only in Part 2A of the opinion.
Okay.
In the back? Oh, sorry. Okay. But we also have one in the back.
I was going to ask another question. Just to raise an objection to your $100 million test, what about rules that have great social and political importance but are not costly to industry? So let's say, for example, you know, transgender bathrooms or something controversial like that.
I hear you.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I was trying to do was to come up with some fairly clear-cut rule, because I wanted a nice mechanism for making the decision of what's significant, what's insignificant. And you got that very nice system in the OIRA that makes that kind of decision. The problem with it is that it says, okay, a rule is significant if it costs more than $100 million per year, or it's important. Well, that is not judicially manageable. So I just wanted to calve off the part of it that's more measurable. But in this article I'm writing, which will be in the Harvard Journal of Law and Public Policy early next year, I point out that Congress, in enacting the statute that gives it sets up a fast-track process, it could include other categories. But in my proposal, I'm not saying, stuff that's important in addition to $100 million, because I don't think it's judicially manageable. But Congress could add that.
Go ahead.
It's Mike Geske from Cause of Action Institute. There's something that Mark mentioned at the very end. When we were watching Gundy go through briefing and coming up and all the amici, I thought that perhaps the court, with its new coming majority, might be willing, instead of putting its toe just in the whole administrative lake, might go full immersion on the criminal side. Is there any... What do you think about that? It doesn't seem like it played much of a distinction this time.
There is the $500,000.
Yeah, I agree that it didn't make much of a distinction this time. And I don't know how much of that was hinged on the fact that Alito was... The fact that there weren't nine justices, the fact that... So, for example, if we did have a full complement of nine, would Alito have been as reticent to cast a vote here? I don't know. If I were a betting man, I would rather see a civil case come up now. That said, the bump stock case is making its way up to the court, so it may soon have another criminal case to look at. Although that's not primarily a non-delegation argument.
Difference, David. Final. So we're out of time. I want to make two observations in closing. One, never come to an event and sit between two litigators, because you just buffeted back and forth. Now, you're a great sport, David, and I think your points are excellent, and this was a great panel in my view. But really, more seriously, if you look at Gorsuch's dissent, you'll notice something which we here are very interested in. He cites many scholars. One of the common denominators of many of the scholars, maybe the most common denominator, is many of them are connected to this organization. Now, I say that for two reasons. One is to pat ourselves on the back. Yay, NCLA. I'll list them out. Philip Hamburger, David, who's on our board of advisors, Gary Lawson, also on our board of advisors, and Janice Rogers Brown.
And but Peter Wallison.
And Peter Wallison.
Oh, no,
so,
I'm sorry. Oh,
was he not? Was, anyway.
I'm sorry. But the
broader point, and the more serious point, I mean, it's wonderful for us, and I think a real testament to the people involved in this organization. But the broader point is this. In order to, and I don't think of what we do primarily as fighting the administrative state. I'd like to think about it in the positive as creating constitutional government increasing freedom and liberty. But either way, it's a big deal. It takes a lot of work. I mean, you think about citing David's book from 1993 and other works. This is works that have been in progress and thinking that's been going on for three decades. It takes scholars, it takes doers to really change the world and do what we're trying to do. It's a huge battle. It's a very important battle. So I just want to say thanks to, you know, Mark and David and anybody who's participated in this really hard work of reasserting or reestablishing constitutional government. And thank all you for coming. Thanks.